Welcome back. It's a Friday, the 22nd day of February 2018. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And if there's a predominant theme to the news this week, it has to do with media hate hoaxes. Most of the waste stream clearly hates a whole lot of things, but close to the top of the list, the God of the Bible, the Constitution for these formerly free United States, and of course, white males and anybody else that recognizes any of that. Hitler, of course, famously called them deplorables, while Bathhouse Berry preferred the term bitter clingers to their guns, God, and Bibles. By whatever name, though, it's increasingly obvious that the waste stream media, and all of those that drink their Kool-Aid, are so incredibly tolerant of everything except the stuff that they hate, that they're willing to lie, cheat, steal, be really gullible, and even kill when it suits their purposes. Because ultimately, if there's one unifying philosophy on the far left, it's that the ends justify the means. And we'll get back to some of the obvious manifestations of that from this week, and they were literally legion, after we talk about one of the less obvious ones, which of course is not only civil war, that seems to be pretty well on track, but also World War III, too. Because some of us can remember when the left was anti-war. Obviously, that's a long ways in the rearview mirror now, but what we do see is both wings of that same evil bird of prey, the neocons and the far left, flapping in unison when it comes to saying, we're looking for a fight and we don't seem to care where we find it. And I guess we ought to start in Venezuela, although there are multiple candidates. Midweek, Michael Snyder wrote that we're getting dangerously close to war with Venezuela. He quoted a Trump threat saying all options are open when it comes to perhaps using the U.S. military to support regime change or the Venezuelan Constitution. Hey, don't we all wish they paid even remotely as much attention to the U.S. Constitution? I'd have thought President Trump could at least see the irony in that, which kind of speaks volumes about who really may be in charge. Anyway, just to set the stage, here are a slew of late-in-the-week headlines. Moscow accuses Trump, says one from the UK's Daily Mail, of sending special forces to Venezuela, and calls the push to deliver aid a convenient pretext for military action as the crisis approaches the boiling point. Two dead, 14 injured, said a story from the WAPO. As Venezuelan troops open fire on civilians trying to keep the border with Brazil open for aid, just one day after Guaido's trucks rammed through roadblocks. Cuba has accused the U.S. of preparing for military action in Venezuela, said another story from Zero Hedge, summarizing several others. Moscow, via RT, has warned that a U.S.-run border provocation is set to topple Maduro over the weekend. Does sound like a reprise of Bashar al-Assad to an extent, doesn't it? And as if all that wasn't enough, and the threat of a proxy war with Russia, perhaps in Venezuela, if it doesn't work in the Ukraine, didn't already make the point, Vladimir Putin sounds like he's pretty much had enough. Maybe by now both he and President Trump have figured out that they're simply not going to be allowed to have peace, so what the heck? Here's another international headline, also from the Daily Mail. I'm ready, said Putin, for a new Cuban missile crisis if you want one. He threatened Trump with a return to the Cold War confrontation that brought the world to the brink of nuclear Armageddon, says their headline, hearkening back to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, where the Soviet Union similarly put missiles just 90 miles from the Florida coast. And he's still saying he doesn't want an arms race, or worse, with the United States, but he would have no choice but to act if Washington goes ahead with deployment of new intermediate-range missiles in Europe, some of which he said would be able to strike Moscow within 10 to 12 minutes. Speaking on Friday morning during his equivalent of the U.S. State of the Union address, President Putin threatened that his missiles could reach the U.S. faster than theirs could hit Moscow. He said, it's their right, meaning the Americans, to think how they want, but can they count? I'm sure they can. Let them count the speed and the range of the weapon systems we are developing, Putin told Russia's political elite to strong applause, adding that Russia will be forced to create and deploy types of weapons which can be used not only in respect to those territories from which the direct threat to us originates, I think he's referring to Europe there, but also in respect to those territories where the centers of decision-making are located. Unquote. He also boasted about Russia's expanding new array of nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles, for their Navy as part of efforts to counter what he described as hostile U.S. moves. The new Zircon missile flies at Mach 9, or 9 times the speed of sound, and has a range of 620 miles, he warned, adding that the missile is designed to be used on existing surface ships and submarines. Basically warning, you park your missiles on our western border, we'll park ours off of both your coasts. And let's not forget, they've still got their nuclear Poseidon underwater drone, a.k.a. tsunami weapon, allegedly capable of inundating the entire eastern seaboard, and so on. And when I see stories like this one, folks, 222 socialists in the House have signed on to a resolution to overturn Trump's national border emergency and continue to encourage a southern invasion, I can't help but think they're all but begging both China and Russia to come on in and foment the communist revolution that they haven't been able to get traction on yet. So bottom line, after a week like this, you do have to ask, who's the biggest threat to America? Honestly, probably not Vladimir Putin. Remember that Californian Eric Swalwell has already threatened to nuke Americans if they won't turn over their guns. Is it Kamala Hateful Harris? Or maybe treasonous Andrew McCabe? And perhaps at least one of his partners in crime, Rod I'll Wear a Wire Rosenstein, when it comes to undermining the president via the 25th Amendment? Witch hunter Robert Mueller's gotten kind of quiet. Nutty Nancy Pelosi, Mad Maxine Waters, or brainless Sandy Occasional Cortex? Well, certainly they're all on the list, along with the regular cast of communist characters. But I guess what really characterizes this week, and I alluded to it up front, is just how unhinged all of this unleashed media hatred and the hoaxes that go with it have now gotten. The Jussie Smollett, I Hate Trump hoax was just the latest, and it's been going on for several weeks now. What set it apart from the get-go was that it was so bogus only the most gullible could even fall for it. And that seems to include almost all of Hollywood, the knee-jerk left in the swamp, and every three-letter network in the Ministry of Truth you can think of. By early in the week, the latest media hate hoax was coming apart at the seams. Chicago police eventually said Smollett paid two acquaintances, the Nigerian men, $3,500 to stage the January 29th hoax attack, and of course blame the president, that he's been so vocal for a long time now about hating. Eventually, the hoaxer was thrown under the bus, arrested, and may or may not end up getting the traditional scapegoat slap on the wrist before he achieves his much-coveted martyrdom. Even the AP wrote this late in the week. As authorities laid out their case against Smollett, the narrative that emerged Thursday sounded like that of a filmmaker who wrote, cast, directed, and starred in a short movie. Prosecutors said Smollett gave detailed instructions to the accomplices who helped him stage the attack in January, including telling them specific slurs to yell, urging them to shout about MAGA country, and even pointing out a surveillance camera that he thought would record the beating. The hoaxer then returned triumphantly to the set of his TV show, where 20th Century Fox TV later tweeted, quote, Jussie Smollett continues to be a consummate professional on set, and as we have previously stated, he is not being written out of the show. But oops, there are at least a few people pointing out the hypocrisy of this. Paul Joseph Watson of Prison Planet wrote the following, and it really resonates. Roseanne, remember her, tweeted something offensive and was fired, whereupon the entire show was rewritten. And what she did by any measure, folks, was one hell of a lot less offensive than what Smollett tried to get away with. Yeah, as Watson continued, Smollett, though, faked a hate crime. Kind of hard to claim that was an innocent mistake or joke gone bad. Risks racial violence across America, and he's already back on the set of Empire today. And that was written Thursday, February 21st. One rule for them, concludes Watson, another for everyone else. He was also excoriated by Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson, who said, quote, this stunt was orchestrated by Smollett because he was dissatisfied with his salary. Well, maybe there was more to it, folks, but we may or may not ever hear all the truth there. So he concocted a story about being attacked. Why would anyone, he added, especially an African-American man, use the symbolism of a noose to make false accusations? Well, folks, maybe as it turns out, shame really does trump hypocrisy, because by Friday morning, this was the tune that was being played by 20th Century Fox TV. The events of the past few weeks have been incredibly emotional for all of us. Jussie has been an important member of our Empire family for the past 5 years, and we care about him deeply, reads a joint statement from the show's executive producers. And then there was this. We're also aware of the effects of this process on the cast and crew members who work on our show, and to avoid further disruption on set, we have decided to remove the role of Jamal from the final two episodes of the season." Unquote. Shame, however, doesn't seem to work on some communists, especially when they sit on the floor of Congress. Remember socialist announced presidential candidate Kamala Harris, who drank the Kool-Aid on January 29th, and in typical knee-jerk fashion tweeted this: "At Jussie Smollett is one of the kindest, most gentle human beings I know." Whereupon she added, "This was an attempted modern-day lynching. No one should have to fear for their life because of their sexuality or color of their skin. We must confront this hate." Unquote. Later, she looked like she was trying to deny even remembering that tweet, and she or somebody on her staff deleted it. But the embarrassment didn't stop her and Cory Booker from exploiting the propaganda hysteria to try to get a bill passed to expand federal hate crimes to include lynching, as if it wasn't already a crime. But when it comes to hubris, nobody tops the self-congratulatory left, who not only know how to run your lives, but how you ought to feel about it, too. After the Smollett circus on Thursday, she issued a statement and basically doubled down, saying we shouldn't focus on Smollett's staged attack because that distracts from the truth that, quote, hate crimes are on the rise in America, unquote. And since she wants to do it for us, I'll try it for her. Yeah, hate crimes are on the rise. So why didn't she come out and say it? That means we're succeeding. Because what she didn't bother to mention, but Chris Menahan at Information Liberation did, is that, at least until they changed the metrics, FBI statistics claim that it's in fact anti-white hate crimes that are the fastest growing racial hate crimes in America with a K. The hoaxes, however, paint an entirely different picture. And if we have time, because there's a whole lot of them, we'll reprise some of that a bit later on. All right, well, moving on, we're still working up to what the smoke is really obscuring. Like another one we've heard for a long time that the waste stream wants to call you a conspiracy theorist, if you even think could be a possibility, and that's sedition and, of course, outright treason. And perhaps unwittingly, because maybe they've still got the same agenda and they're trying to help McCabe sell his book, CBS and 60 Minutes are making the case for treason via the back door. We started talking about this story last week, since former deputy director of the FBI and Whoremeister Jr., Andy McCabe, basically came out tooting his own horn and bragging about his intentions to undermine a sitting, duly elected U.S. president. And that immediately makes him a media and Hollywood darling, because, you know, the ends still justify the means, even if the fraud he was perpetuating makes anything Jussie Smollett ever thought of look not only tiny, but downright trivial by comparison, which is why Smollett makes such a great smokescreen. So let's start our look at the myriad aspects of this story via a news source that at least looks a heck of a lot more reliable than the WAPO New York Times and criminally negligent network. I'm talking about RT out of Russia, that says the ex-FBI director, acting DAG, will be subpoenaed over the latest coup attempt. This according to Senator Lindsey Graham. And the piece from over the weekend begins by saying earlier in the week, former acting director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, revealed that the U.S. intelligence SIC community had considered removing the U.S. president from office back in May of 2017 after he unexpectedly, yeah sure, how about belatedly, fired the FBI's then-director and whoremeister, James Comey. And after those first revelations by McCabe, but even before the 60 Minutes interview actually aired, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, promised he would hold a hearing on McCabe's comments about that discussion to remove the sitting president, which he described, correctly, as an administrative coup. Don't worry, they've got other ones in the works, too, as we already know. McCabe claimed to CBS that he ordered two investigations into President Trump because he wanted to know if Trump fired FBI Director Comey to impede the Russia investigation, which, of course, is a bald-faced lie, as we now know, because he knew darn well why Trump fired that scumbag. And, he says, was Trump acting on behalf of the Russian government? Well, since then, even though they dropped the story after reporting it only about once, the waste stream has had to admit there was zero evidence that President Trump was working on behalf of the Russian government, and there was zero evidence that Trump conspired with the Russians to win the 2016 presidential election, in spite of the other rigging, which goes unreported. And even the Whoremeister himself, James Comey, testified to Congress back in December that by the time he was fired, there was no evidence of any type of conspiracy between Trump and Russia. But still, lied McCabe to CBS, there was something, quote, that troubled me greatly. Yeah, let's be clear here. It was the fact that they were pretty close to getting caught, and he knew what that would mean, not just the loss of his pension. CBS's Scott Pelley threw this softball to the scumbag. Quote, how long was it after that you decided to start the obstruction of justice and counterintelligence investigations involving the president? Well, said the national security threat, quote, I think the next day I met with the team investigating the Russia cases, and I asked the team to go back and conduct an assessment to determine where we are with these efforts and what steps we do need to take going forward. Not that we don't have at least a few texts showing they were already pretty well prepped on that score. Quote, I was very concerned that I was able to put the Russia case on absolutely solid ground in an indelible fashion, that were I removed quickly or reassigned or fired, that the case could not be closed or vanish in the night without a trace, unquote. And for that, of course, I rely on the waste stream media to cover my back and the DOJ to cover our tracks. And then listen to this and understand it in context. McCabe, says the summary from the Gateway Pundit, also went into great detail about Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's plot to wear a wire so that he could record President Trump and attempt to destroy him via the 25th Amendment. Quote, I never get searched when I go into the White House. I could easily wear a recording device, Rosenstein allegedly told McCabe. Here's a bit of that clip from 60 Minutes.
The Deputy Attorney General offered to wear a wire into the White House. He said, I never get searched when I go into the White House. I could easily wear a recording device. They wouldn't know it was there. Now, he was not joking. He was absolutely serious. And in fact, he brought it up in the next meeting we had.
Which, of course, means at least one of them was lying, although neither were under oath in these cases. Because when this came out months and months ago, Rosenstein said, ha ha, I was only joking. As if undermining a duly elected president was then a laughing matter. And then the scumbag went on to say,
but to be fair, it was an unbelievably stressful time. I can't even describe for you how many things must have been coursing through the Deputy Attorney General's mind at that point.
And somehow he felt the need to keep emphasizing the chaos and the stress. Here's another quote. I can't describe to you accurately enough the pressure and the chaos that Rod and I were trying to operate under at that time. It was incredibly turbulent, incredibly stressful, unquote. And I guess the threat of actually being caught and going at minimum to prison, or worse still, execution for treason, could have that effect. The president himself, obviously a bit miffed while watching these whoppers on parade, went into one of his biggest tweet storms yet. He referred to lying McCabe telling a, quote, deranged story and plotting a very illegal act, saying it was the insurance policy in plain view and noting, among a bunch of other things, quote, wow, so many lies by now disgraced acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe. He was fired for lying, and now his story gets even more deranged. He and Rod Rosenstein, who was hired by Jeff Sessions, another beauty, looked like they were planning a very illegal act and got caught. McCabe, he continued, has a lot of explaining to do. And then he quoted Dan Bongino, among others, on Fox and Friends, noting that this was an illegal coup attempt against the sitting president of the United States. Other stories have confirmed that report of sedition and an attempted coup. Zero Hedge, citing Bloomberg and Fox News, says two Trump cabinet officials were, quote, ready to support that DOJ scheme to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove President Trump. No, they won't say which, but there are certainly more than two Obama holdovers to pick from. Citing closed-door testimony delivered last fall before the House Oversight and Judiciary Committees by FBI former top lawyer James Baker, he said that both McCabe and former FBI lawyer and liar Lisa Page approached him to relay their conversations with Rosenstein, including discussions about that 25th Amendment scheme. FBI Office of the General Counsel Sally Moyer also confirmed the reports secondhand. And all of this, folks, is just the latest in an increasing mountain of evidence long obscured, hidden, denied, and lied about by the FBI and their bosses at the DOJ that have made the increasingly undeniable case for 2 years that there really was election rigging in process both before and after the November 2016 election, and it was never the dreaded Ruskies, but it was always the swamp critters. And just as obviously, it was about denying and covering up all kinds of crimes, up to and including treason, that had been going on for years prior to that. From there we go to a great story that I think is very timely from Robert Mary via the American Conservative blog, as well as other places, that asks the question, do you believe in the deep state now? After the revelation that top Just Us officials considered unseating Trump, well, you'd think that would answer the question for good. Be afraid, be very afraid, he begins. That's a natural reaction to the revelation of Andrew McCabe, former deputy FBI director and whoremeister, that top DOJ officials, supposedly alarmed by Trump's firing of former bureau director James Comey, explored a plan to invoke the 25th Amendment and kick the duly elected president out of office. By now, we might even have to be calling that insurance policy Plan B. He recaps the story. We've just done that, so let me continue. The claim is, arguably because he wasn't Hitlery, the president was therefore unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, quoting the 25th Amendment. But to understand what kind of constitutional crisis that would unleash and the precedent it would set, suggests Mary, it's necessary to ponder the rest of that section of the 25th Amendment. The text prescribes that if the president, after being removed, transmits to that same congressional set of figures that he is indeed capable of discharging his duties, he would once again be president after 4 days. But if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet reiterate their declaration within those 4 days that the guy just can't govern, Congress is charged with deciding the issue, which then takes a two-thirds vote of both houses to keep him removed. And all of that would have to be done within 21 days, during which time the elected president would be sidelined, and the VP, if he was able, would govern. But if Congress can't muster that two-thirds majority within the prescribed time period, the president, quote, shall resume the powers and duties of his office. So yeah, it's almost impossible, writes Mary, to contemplate the political conflagration that would ensue under this plan. But we might just be getting an idea if we've been paying attention for the last couple of years. No doubt debates would flare up over whether this comported with the original intent. I think you'd find it kind of funny that people who never gave a you-know-what about original intent before might be suddenly finding it really compelling now. And whether it was merely crafted to deal with the issue of physical or mental incapacitation of a president, like, oh, I don't know, what we've seen with, at the very least, a Supreme Court justice, as opposed to controversial actions, unsubstantiated allegations, we've got a lot of those, or even erratic decision-making, and whether such an action, if established as precedent, could destabilize what's left of the American Republic for all time. And whether unelected bureaucrats would then arrogate to themselves, if they haven't already, the power to set in motion the downfall of a president, circumventing completely the impeachment and conviction language in the Constitution, and saving at least the House a whole lot of time. Well, Robert Mary suggests the country has been struggling with two competing narratives. One, he calls it Narrative A, is that a bunch of honorable and dedicated federal law enforcement officials, having seen things that concerned them, even though somehow treason by Hitlery didn't, decided it was necessary to get rid of the president by any means necessary. The other view, he calls it Narrative B, posits that certain bureaucratic mandarins of the national security state and the outgoing Obama regime resolved early on to thwart the presidency of somebody who wasn't supposed to win anyway. Yeah, folks, I think the evidence is increasingly undeniably clear, so I'm not hiding my opinion, any more than the Clinton News Network has been hiding theirs. Now, says Mary, there's no doubt that McCabe and Rosenstein and Strzok and Brennan and Page and so many others simply despise Trump, his resolve to thaw relations with Russia, and arguably anything having to do with making America great again. And they saw themselves as needing to rein him in, as CNN described the sentiment among top FBI officials after the firing of the whoremeister Comey. And now we learn, surprise, 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 that they not only distorted the rules of official behavior designed to rein them in, but they actually sat around and plotted about how to distort the Constitution as well, to the point where it's not only getting harder to dismiss Narrative B, but the whole idea of a deep state that sees the Constitution as just another impediment in the way of their globalist totalitarian state. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening's show. I'm still your host, Mark Hall, and we're still talking about media hate hoaxes and other great big lies that seem to all be pointing in a single direction. Call it tyranny by any means necessary. So let's kick this one off with a story about Laura Logan, at least now we can say former CBS foreign correspondent and news reporter, who suffers from a problem when it comes to working for the three-letter fake news media. She has integrity, and she may now be out of a job, too, not because she committed a hate crime hoax, but because she told the truth. In a widely covered interview that the journalist admitted was probably professional suicide, Laura Logan called out the waste-stream media for being, quote, mostly liberal, particularly when it came to their unvarnished animus against President Trump. During an appearance on the Mic Drop podcast with retired Navy SEAL Mike Ritland, the veteran journalist admitted that, quote, the media everywhere is mostly liberal, not just the U.S., adding that it was nearly impossible for viewers to decipher if they were being told the truth at any given time. Quote, 85% of journalists, she said, are registered Democrats, unquote. If you actually exclude the ones who aren't really journalists at all, folks, maybe that number gets quite a bit more reasonable looking. Anyway, she continued, how do you know you're being lied to? How do you know you're being manipulated? How do you know there's something not right with the coverage? Well, when they simplify it all and there's no gray, it's all one way. Life, she said, isn't like that. If it doesn't match real life, it's probably not. Something's wrong. For example, all the coverage on Trump all the time is negative. And that, she said, is a distortion of the way things go in real life. There's no gray. It's all one way. She went on to say that journalists today are more or less lobbyists for leftist interest, adding that the weight of the liberal news media machine overwhelms, quote, the other side, unless people actively seek out other outlets, such as Breitbart. And noting recent comments by former New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson, Logan said, although the media has historically always been left-leaning, we've abandoned our pretense, or at least the effort, to be objective today. We've become political activists, and some could argue propagandists, and there's some merit to that. And she wasn't done. She added that MSM reports using anonymous or single government sources are bunk, saying, quote, that's not journalism, it's horseshit. Responsibility for fake news begins with us, unquote. The South African-born foreign affairs journalist achieved some notoriety in 2013, and not necessarily for a good reason, when she did a report for 60 Minutes about the 2012 attacks on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, along with the assassination of the ambassador. And imagine this, her eyewitness evidently later told a different story to the FBI than he'd told her. CBS, it says, conducted a review of the matter and found that other media outlets like the New York Times and the WAPO were reporting things differently. So after she was targeted by Media Matters for America, infamous leftist fact-checkers, or as she put it, the known Clinton propaganda organization, she was forced to take a leave of absence from CBS. And I did find her summary of the fact that there isn't much variety in viewpoints when it comes to the major waste stream news organizations kind of telling. Here's how she put it. Visually, anyone who's ever been to Israel and been to the Wailing Wall has seen that the women have this tiny little spot in front of the wall to pray, and the rest of the wall is for the men, she said. To me, that's a great representation of the American media, in that in this tiny little corner where the women pray, you've got Breitbart and Fox News and a few others. And from there on, you have CBS, ABC, NBC, HuffPo, Politico, whatever, right? All of them. And that, she said, is a problem for me. My experience has been that the more opinions you have, the more ways you look at everything in life, unquote. Well, basically, the closer you get to the truth. Because everything, she said, is gray, right? Well, folks, not on the leftist media. Even if it's green on the outside, like a watermelon, it's red to the core. Which brings me to the story I've been working up to. But actually, we've talked about it before. It's just that now it's so over the top, it can't be dismissed. Speaker for the traitors, Nancy Pelosi, is now among several that have come forward and said, yep, when we get the reins of power, our president will declare a national emergency and confiscate all of you deplorables' firearms, because Donald Trump showed us the way. Nutcase Jerry Nadler from New York on CNN, where else, expanded on that same threat, saying this, Trump's declaration opens up tyranny or dictatorship because that's what would happen if you let presidents declare national emergencies. And it does kind of make you wonder, where have these blithering idiots been since March of 1933, with almost as many national emergencies as Congress has communists. And if you just read them, folks, you'd realize Bathhouse Barry himself has already reiterated the emergency declaration that would allow a president to take not just firearms, but everything that every American ever dreamed of owning anyway. Look up Executive Order 13603 if you have any doubts. This next item I've already promised. I've been thinking about doing it myself for quite a while anyway. Turns out a real journalist named Andy Ngo put the whole list together for me, and it was up on Zero Hedge the other day, under the title, Giant List of Mainstream Media-Fueled Hate Crime Hoaxes Meant to Frame Trump Supporters. Yep, you want the definitive story of at least most of the waste stream hoaxes that have been perpetrated over just the last couple of years? Here you go. As Brian Stelter and CNN Work Overtime begins the summary here of all of these tweets via Tyler Durden, to pretend that the MSM didn't uncritically promote Jussie Smollett's absurd hate crime claim in a giddy rush to frame Trump supporters as violent, journalist Andy Ngo has pushed back. In a running thread of hate crime hoaxes that the MSM either uncritically reported or gave little attention to once the actual truth came out, Ngo lists hoax after hoax designed to smear conservatives. So here you go. In basically the order he published them, dating back the better part of about 2.5 years, right after Donald Trump's election, the SPLC, he says, really stoked panic. A pro-gay Episcopal church in Indiana was vandalized with, quote, Heil Trump, a swastika, and an anti-gay slur. Turns out that, too, was the gay organ player who done it. He was charged, though, only with a misdemeanor. Then, from 2018, days after the Pittsburgh massacre, Trump supporters were blamed for Nazi vandalism at a Brooklyn synagogue and fires in a Jewish community. Turns out, hey, what do you expect? Again, the perpetrator was a gay black man who had worked with the city council on a supposed initiative to fight hate crimes. Well, there you have it. One more time, we see the ends really do, at least in some eyes, justify the means. And for each of these, he cites the appropriate local news coverage. Then from February 17th of this year, Andy Ngo says, 1 week before the presidential election, a black church in Mississippi was burned via an arson attack while Vote Trump was written on the building. After much panic, an investigation revealed the man responsible, church member Andrew McClinton, who, yes, remember, this was a black church, so he probably isn't the poster child for right-wing white male extremism. In November 16, continues the list, a Muslim student at the University of Louisiana said that two white racists, say it with me, Trump supporters brutally assaulted her, ripped off her hijab, and robbed her. The story, of course, went viral, and of course, it was a lie. Media never identified her by name after the hoax was revealed. Next, I remember, says Ngo, that Trump and his supporters were blamed for a spate of anti-Semitic KKK and Nazi graffiti on the campus of Nassau Community College in Long Island in late 2016. The student responsible turns out to have been Jaskirat Saini. December 2016, a Muslim woman said she was attacked by three white male Trump supporters in New York City, on the subway, who, of course, tried to rip off her hijab. Yasmin Saweed lied. Kara, though, said Muslims are under tremendous stress and pressure, resulting in incidents just like this. Going back to September 2018, a black woman in Long Island said Trump supporters confronted her, told her, quote, she didn't belong here. Her car tire was slashed the next day, and a hateful note was left saying, go home. Turns out, Adwoa Lewis made up the whole story. And he quotes NBC New York, local coverage there. In November 2018, students at Goucher College demanded social justice training and safe spaces after, you know, racist Nazi and KKK graffiti was found on campus. Someone even wrote out the names of black students. Trump, of course, was blamed. Instead, a black student named Finn Arthur was responsible. 2017, at St. Olaf College, mass protests roiled the campus in response to anti-black notes found all over the place. Class was canceled, the administration caved to demands, and an investigation found that Samantha Wells, a black victim of one of the notes, actually fabricated the entire incident. November 2016, a Philadelphia neighborhood was rattled when property was vandalized with pro-Trump and anti-black messages. William Tucker was identified as that vandal through closed-circuit TV footage. And no, folks, he doesn't look white male. November 2016, a black female student at Villanova in Pennsylvania said a group of white men yelling Trump knocked her to the ground on campus. However, a police and university investigation was halted because the student decided, she didn't want to pursue the matter. November 2017, at K-State University, a black man's car was vandalized with racist messages. Class was canceled. Students held demonstrations. Dontarius Williams later admitted that he did it to his own car. Hey, folks, if it's racist to speculate about why somebody of a certain color did something, is it also racist to speculate why somebody of another color doesn't get charged? Well, in any case, for whatever reason, this guy didn't get charged. In autumn 2018 at K-State, a note was left on an apartment, too, that said, "Beware N-persons." You know the word, folks, and I'm not going to say it. "Knock at your own risk." The victim admitted to police that he did it to himself. And that was the second time that the same he person had fabricated a hate incident in less than 2 years. Meanwhile, at the University of Michigan, student Haley Bass told police a Trump supporter, who else, attacked her by scratching her face. In November 2016, she said she was targeted for wearing a pin in support of UK Remain. As her story fell apart, she admitted she'd scratched herself. Then there was the spate of death threats to Jewish community centers across the U.S. Trump, of course, was blamed, but instead, Juan Thompson, a reporter who worked for The Intercept, was convicted for the hoax, threats, and other offenses. And no, he doesn't look like a white male either. Andy Ngo, of course, actually includes the pictures along with the links, so that if there's any doubt, you can decide for yourself, just in case you're curious. 2016, another Muslim student, this time at the University of Michigan, claims she was attacked by a white man who threatened to burn her hijab, but that one, too, never happened. The terrorist-affiliated CARE, Council on American-Islamic Relations, though, said the attack is, quote, just the latest anti-Muslim incident reported since the election of Donald Trump. Going back to one day after the election, Alicia Long, student at Bowling Green State University, or BGSU, in Ohio, claimed, what else? White males wearing Trump shirts threw rocks at her and hurled racial slurs. The incident sparked a rage on campus. The university hosted a town hall, and Long made it all up. On election night, Canadian Chris Ball said he was beaten by anti-gay Trump supporters in Santa Monica. His friend shared a photo on socialist media where Ngo says, hey, note the immaculate watch. Police, though, say he never filed a report and didn't bother to go to any of the hospitals in the area. Which brings us to Charlotte, April 2017, when Curtis Flournoy set an immigrant business on fire and left a note saying, quote, Trump is our nation builder for white America. When the closed-circuit TV footage showed that the perpetrator was, in fact, black, some sites said it was a white Trump supporter in disguise. That from the Charlotte Observer. Hey, folks, I know. Maybe it was Governor Northam, Democrat from Virginia. November 2016, students at Williams College dumped fake blood on campus and wrote AM KKK kill. Campus police notified the FBI and state police, and investigation actually found that perpetrators did it themselves to, quote, bring attention to the effects of the presidential election. Are you starting to see kind of a consistent pattern here? Finally, there's November 2016, Chicago, when Taylor Volk, a bisexual student at NPU, said she received hateful pro-Trump, anti-gay messages, quote, this is a countrywide epidemic all of a sudden, she said at the time. You know what? That may be one of the only true things in this, folks. It's just not for the reason that the false flag hoaxers are pushing. The investigation, say it with me, discovered that, imagine this, yes, you know it, she fabricated the story. I'll say it this way. It's hard to know whether these people learned it from the waste-stream media, or the waste-stream media has just taken their cues from the same, well, anti-scriptural, anti-constitutional, anti-biblical, you name it, but at least it's consistent, adversarial to truth, etc., deep state leadership. So let's go on to the Brookings Institution, brookings.edu, for some propaganda of an entirely different kind. albeit no less deadly. In a feature called Tech Tank, a piece written by Tom Wheeler, who served as the 31st chairman of the Federal Communications Commission at the end of the Obama regime. It's actually dated a couple of months back, but hey, it keeps getting recycled. And are you ready for the misleading, even propaganda-oriented headline? The real 5G race, he says, is to serve all Americans. Well, take your own service and stick it where the sun don't shine, Tom. Some of us would rather live than watch movies faster. It begins this way, and I won't read much of it, don't worry. He talked about a September White House rally to promote U.S. leadership in the fifth generation 5G wireless technology. I was part of a similar event at the Clinton White House, you know, Rape Central, in 1993, that promoted the importance of making more spectrum available through auctions that were then being considered by Congress. This time around, it looks like the messaging will be concerning the 5G race between the United States and China. And it goes on to talk about how important the race is and all the billions, even trillions of dollars that are at stake. The first thing to know, he said, about 5G, and this is a partial whopper, because it's really not the first thing, but it goes with it, is that the Obama FCC made the United States the first nation in the world to set aside high-band millimeter wave spectrum for 5G applications. Military weapons applications, of course, seem to have preceded that. He goes on to tell us about all the companies that are rolling out this poison in multiple cities throughout this year and the next. But no, trouble is, you don't transition to a new generation of technology immediately. Simply flip a switch and go from one generation to the next. These things must be done delicately. They're evolutionary. So here I'll pause and mention just two things. One, the word health doesn't appear in this story, nor does any indication whatsoever that there might be any little problem with rolling out this 5G weaponry, and that's what it is, all across America and the world. Or for that matter, any downside whatsoever. But there is this. The true national leadership challenge, he writes, for 5G is less a race, he puts it in quotes, than whether its benefits will be available to all Americans. Ubiquitous 5G is a national cause worth fighting for. Some of us folks will fight for the death against it because that's what we're talking about. But hey, back to this stuff. But it will require more than industry and government lip service. The 5G deployments announced thus far are in urban and suburban areas. Large parts of rural America, though, are still waiting for 4G LTE, despite government subsidies to companies to encourage such expansion. What's missing, he said, in the U.S. is a race to deliver 5G to all Americans, whether we want it slammed down our throats and irradiating our bodies, I think, or not. But back to the quote here, to accomplish universal 5G, we must replace expedient political battle cries with creative thinking by both government and industry to maximize scarce capital, maintain competition, and deliver the promise of high-speed, low-latency 5G service to every American, unquote, whether they like it or not, whether they don't want it in their house or their neighborhood or not, and whether they know what's good for them or not. Let me be as blunt as I can here, and that's fairly blunt, folks, as you know. If we can't trust them to tell us the truth about the Constitution or what's being done to destroy it at multiple levels, they certainly won't tell you about glyphosates, mercury in vaccines, or genetically modified frankenfoods, much less why they're so anxious to see Americans disarmed and vulnerable to whatever they've got planned next. Why would we trust them to tell us the truth about a so-called wonderful technology that's got a lot more to do with control than it does entertainment and communications? Oh, and one last speculation on this idea of politically correct news coverage that can't be trusted at all. Notice how they're really hot to trot when it comes to disarming Americans. It's all for the children, you know? We can't have these dangerous devices pointed at our little kiddies now, can we? But we certainly want to point all kinds of dangerous devices right in their homes where they sleep. Hell, let's irradiate them 24/7 with millimeter wavelengths. Anybody that has any concern at all about weaponry ought to be a lot more concerned about fully automatic 5G death. They don't even have to reload, than the kind that just might protect you and your neighbors from what they intend to do to you. So here comes the speculation. Just imagine if somebody took one of those military 5G The one I saw the technical specs for operated at 95 gigahertz, they said. Active denial weapons systems into a populated area. Oh, I don't know, like a public school or shopping mall, and beamed down a few hundred innocent people. Do you think maybe somebody'd get the message and say, hey, we don't want this thing on every street corner and in every house? Nah, the press wouldn't report on it anyway. I want to wrap up with at least a bit of a piece by Charles Hugh Smith of TwoMinds.com entitled, Let's Face It, the U.S. Constitution has failed. Because despite the anything-goes quality of what now passes for American culture, one thing remains kind of, sort of, verboten to say publicly. The U.S. Constitution has failed. The reason why this painfully obvious fact cannot be discussed publicly is that it gives the lie to the legitimacy of the entire status quo. Once upon a time, the Constitution was intended to limit, he notes, 1, the power of government, especially over the citizenry, 2, the power of each branch of government, and 3, the power of political and financial elites over the government and the citizenry, as the founders recognized the intrinsic risks of the all-powerful, almighty state, dominated by one branch of government, and the risks of a financial elite corrupting the state to serve their interests above those of the citizenry. Trouble is, the Constitution, he suggests, has failed to place limits on the power of government and on the emergence of unaccountable states within a state, agencies, and on the political power of the financial elites. Now, here I'll suggest, folks, that if you recall what John Adams had to say, it's not so much the Constitution as it is fallen men that are responsible. As Adams put it, this Constitution is fit for the governance of an educated and moral people only. And obviously, for the last couple of decades, if not longer, we're certainly 0-2 on that score. And as he continued, it is totally inadequate to that of any other. Well, there you go. Smith does note that the Constitution has failed in no less than 3 ways. 1, corporations and the super wealthy elite control the machinery of government, and the public interest is no longer represented except as interpreted or filtered through their interests. 2, the nation's central bank, actually prohibited by the Constitution, but the Federal Reserve, which of course is neither federal nor does it have any reserves, has the power to debauch the nation's currency and reward the wealthy via the issuance of new currency and buying treasury bonds in whatever sum it deems necessary at that moment. And certainly the unelected, unconstitutional, public-private Fed is only nominally under the control of anything resembling an elected government. It's, in effect, an independent state within a state that dominates the financial well-being of the entire nation. And here your host notes again that it couldn't even exist if we actually still paid attention to the Constitution for several reasons. 1, the Congress doesn't have the power to delegate its authority to coin money, which brings me to 2. Obviously, paper is not money, and the Constitution clearly says nothing but gold or silver coin will be made a tender in payment of debts. So you'd hope the rest would be obvious. And that simply boils down to we haven't had honest, real money for over a half a century now. And the rot goes back over a century. Finally, 3, the national security state, the alphabet agencies, pick 3 letters, I like to say, FBI, CIA, NSA, BATF, ETC, are all independent states within a state, answerable only to themselves, not to the public or their representatives. And so-called congressional oversight is little more than a feeble rubber stamping of the imperial project. And whatever it is that the unelected national security leadership wants to do at that moment. So the Constitution's core regulatory element, the balancing of executive, legislative, and judicial power, and occasional cortex doesn't even have a clue what those 3 were supposed to be anyway, has broken down. Elections, he notes, now provide the bread and circuses stage drama that's passed off as democracy. And, of course, if you've ever read the document, you know there's no democracy anywhere in the actual Constitution or any other of the supreme law. Every emergency now is met with the ceding of more power to unelected elites in positions to serve their own interests, unless, as we've seen most recently, there are real emergencies having to do with a foreign invasion, which actually is in the Constitution. But nobody pays any attention to that either, because the media is pretty much the 4th branch of government. And as we've seen, they too will lie when it suits them, which is all part and parcel of the same problem.